KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Soma in San Francisco.
Elmwood.
El Sobrane.
Do you live in Richmond?
Yeah.
Coming up, we'll get deep into a water battle on the Monterey Peninsula.
How do you know what's going to happen?
Well, see, that's the thing. You don't. And so how many hydrogeologists does it take to screw in a light bulb? There's like four different ones working on the same project.
Then we meet a photographer helping to tell the stories of queer and trans Asian Americans one snapshot at a time.
I am really more comfortable being behind the scenes and providing and creating platforms for people to use and to uplift stories.
And we'll get a 360-degree view of San Francisco.
Where is the Golden Bridge from here?
Oh, I see.
Audiograph and more today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Even though we had record levels of rainfall this year, there's a constant threat of drought in California. Governor Newsom just issued an executive order demanding a drought climate plan for the next century. Many people are looking to the ocean for a solution. After all, it's an unlimited water supply if you can take away the salt. Plans for desalination plants are popping up all along the coast from San Diego to Salinas. But sometimes they come with many strings attached. KALW's environment reporter Angela Johnston brings us the story of a small town on the Monterey Peninsula that spent years fighting against a desalination plant.
When you're driving down the coast on Highway 1 toward Monterey, you may miss the exit for the tiny city of Marina. It's often overshadowed by its neighbors, Monterey with the aquarium and Cannery Row, Carmel by the sea. But if you take that exit, you'll pass a Walmart, some fast food chains, and rows of hotels. What makes the city stand out? It's dozens of beach trails.
There's an access here, here, here.
Kathy Biala moved to Marina 5 years ago. She's taking me to one of her favorite walking spots on the shore.
And then there's the Salinas River Wildlife Refuge. So we have many different kind of...
Before we reach the beautiful beaches that made her move here, Kathy wants to take me on a little detour.
Here we have the regional pollution control, okay, and then the advanced treatment facilities for sewage.
To the wastewater treatment plant.
This is the Monterey Regional Environmental Park. Talk about a euphemism, right?
And then to the regional landfill. So basically, the garbage dump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the whole region.
And finally, to a sand mining plant, a post-apocalyptic-looking moonscape where sand from marina beaches gets packaged for places like Home Depot, golf courses, and concrete manufacturers. The state determined that it was causing some of the worst beach erosion in California.
See the sand mining up there?
Oh, with the smoke.
Yes.
Kathy tells me these sites tell a bigger story. Most of Marina is disadvantaged, with many residents living below the poverty line. It's why she thinks the wealthier Monterey Peninsula uses the city as a dumping ground for these less desirable pieces of infrastructure. It's something that often happens in poorer communities that don't have the time or money to fight back.
So there's, you know, real concern of us being sort of exploited by more polished, more politically connected and wealthier communities around us.
When we get to the beach, Kathy points out what she considers the next example of this exploitation. The California American Water Company, CalAM for short, wants to build a desalination plant here. The desalination plant would have 7 wells sloping into the ground and sucking up water underneath the dunes, removing the salt and sending it to cities on the Monterey Peninsula. But not Marina. They wouldn't get any of the desalinated water because they're not served by CalAM. But for Kathy and other Marina residents, they oppose the plant because they think it'll cause irreversible damage to their town's ecosystems. Desal plant or not, the region needs water fast.
We need water for the near term, and we do need water for the long term.
Dave Stolt works for the Monterey Peninsula Water Management District. They're like Switzerland in this whole battle, pretty neutral. He says this drama really began in the 80s, when the water company CalAM overpumped the Carmel River, then was forced off a nearby basin. They tried to build a dam, but endangered steelhead trout and red-legged frogs squashed that plan.
And so the federal agencies basically said, don't even think about a dam on the river. Don't come back with another dam proposal.
In the meantime, the aquarium opened and tourism took off. By 2009, CalAmp still hadn't found a new water source. The state water board still wasn't happy.
The state said, hey, remember back 14 years ago when we said you need to get off the river? You haven't made any progress.
And guess what? By 2017, they still weren't off the river. So the water board said they'd start penalizing CalAmp if it didn't create a new water source soon.
And eventually, you get into a point where if you abide by the state's penalties, you don't have enough water to serve our 20,000 hospitality jobs. And so that's a big fear in the business community.
So CalAmp championed the building of a desalination plant. It'll let them meet the water needs of the Monterey Peninsula. Plus, there's this sort of guarantee that it'll never run dry.
You know, obviously the ocean's not going away. I think people are very excited about looking at a drought-proof resource.
But desalination technology costs a lot. It's one of the most expensive ways to secure water, mainly because it takes an incredible amount of energy to do it. It works by pushing millions of gallons of water under very intense pressure through very, very fine membranes to take the salt out of salt water. Desal plants can cost millions of dollars to build and just as much to operate. But CalAmp head engineer Ian Crooks says they've got to do it.
Because it's really the only option left.
As we drive to the plant's future site, he tells me the state put a hold on new Monterey Peninsula water hookups for affordable housing, hotels, businesses, you name it, until CalAmp can secure a new water supply. At the edge of the sand dunes, Ian shows me a test well they drilled back in 2015. All you can really see is a series of plastic tubes attached to one giant stainless steel pipe, a bit wider than a telephone pole, jutting diagonally into the ground toward the ocean. You can only see the tip of it.
This thing's about 725 feet long, the one you're looking at. Down in the middle of it sits a pump.
The big stainless steel pipe slants underground, and at the end, there's a big vent where water gets sucked up. The vent isn't in the ocean. It's pulling up water in deep underground aquifers, close to the edge of the shoreline. The ground acts as its own natural filter. Not having a pipe sticking directly into the ocean means sea creatures and fish won't get sucked up.
We're simply at or near the coast, sticking a straw underground into the basin and capturing it.
But people in the city of Marina, where the wells are located, don't buy it. They don't want the plant in their backyard, and some are calling it a water grab. They believe that since the wells aren't in the ocean, they'd be taking the underground water directly from Marina's own water source. Even though it's salty, they think it's still theirs. And if CalAmp took too much of it, that could cause further harm to Marina's groundwater by removing a barrier between ocean and freshwater.
Can I make a request, please?
Dozens of people pack a coastal commission meeting in Salinas.
Can you please stand up if you were going to speak against the desal project?
Almost the entire room stands up. They've protested everything from how they think the plant will hurt the endangered western snowy plover to how the briny, salty discharge that'll shoot back out of the plant could harm ocean life. But they keep coming back to their groundwater. While CalAmp points to a positive independent environmental impact report and their test wells, Marina's water scientists back up their harm hypothesis with a Stanford study. A helicopter flew an electromagnetic sensor over the area to paint a picture of the water underneath the plant site and map out its salinity.
And so if I'm a really smart judge, I might just go, huh, both arguments make some sense.
That's Dave Stolt again, the guy who manages most of the peninsula's water.
And so, how do you know what's going to happen?
Well, see, that's the thing. You don't. And so you end up, you know, how many hydrogeologists does it take to screw in a light bulb? There's like four different ones working on the same project.
So what matters most? The needs of an entire peninsula and a tourism industry, or a small town's agency to govern its landscape and prepare for its future?
But the interesting thing here is, one way to find out is build it and then see what happens. And 7 years into it, you might go, oh, oops, all of our assumptions were wrong.
But you can't unbuild a project, and fixing it may be even more expensive than building it in the first place. For now, the city of Marina and CalAm are involved in a back-and-forth battle of lawsuits and permit denials and appeals with almost all levels of government. CalAm hopes to break ground by the end of this year on the desalination project, just in time to avoid penalties from the state. But in its most recent quarterly report, CalAm's parent company said, quote, there can be no assurance that the water supply project will be completed on a timely basis, if ever. In Marina, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Angela Johnston is our environment reporter. You can contact her at environment@kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Mia Nakano is a photographer and archivist with an interest in LGBTQ stories. But she used to struggle to find resources on queer and trans Asian American history. So she took it upon herself to begin documenting their experiences. Today, Mia is the executive director and co-founder of the Resilience Archives, an organization that blends visual and performance arts to share the narratives and stories of Bay Area LGBTQ Asian Pacific Americans. Mia sat down with KALW's Janae Darden to share her story from behind the lens.
My parents, because they're both Japanese, right? My dad was a Japanese immigrant. My mom was a Japanese American. Had very different experiences because of the war, right? My mom was basically raised in the incarceration camps. And that is a history that I learned about when I was 12 or 13 years old. And it was the only thing that I ever saw reflected about my community in school, right? Until much older when I start to seek it out. And my mom told me about growing up and playing with clothespins in a horse stall with dirt floors. And she was like, so like, you have to be aware, Mia, this is when I'm like literally like 11, 12 years old, that your rights can be taken away at any moment in time.
So how old were you when your father passed away?
I was about 6 and a half.
And what kind of impact did that have on you?
I mean, I think it has and still has a huge impact, right? Even though I'm 41 right now, I still think about him every day. And I think about how our lives just have been fundamentally different without him there. And I also think about the ways that my mom really stepped up and provided for us in all the different ways that she could without him there. Like, I call my mom every Mother's Day and every Father's Day, you know, to thank you for being both parents to me.
How was your mother? I don't know. Did you have a process of coming out to her? Or because mamas know. Or does she know?
So I came out to my mom without knowing this, actually. I came out to my mom on National Coming Out Day, which I think is sometime in October. And I wrote a story for Hyphen Magazine about this, like kind of a pithy story. And she said, you know, Mia, I've always taught you and your sister to be really strong, to do the things that you want to do, and to be successful in all the ways that you want to be. And I've encouraged that. But for the love of God, will you please just get your college degree? That's all I've ever asked of you. And so it was like that. It's like Asian mom guilt, like wrapped up in acceptance, which is, I think, the most beautiful thing. It's just like, here's this one thing that I've, this only thing that I've ever asked of you. And I was like, okay, mom.
What made you pick up the camera?
After my dad died, I found this 35 millimeter camera in my parents' closet that I wasn't allowed into, and I wasn't allowed to pick it up. And ironically, the closet was a place that I used to hide to feel safe because there were so many people around our house when I was younger and after he passed. And I would just sit and, you know, wind the camera and hear it click, and it was very satisfying. And the camera was just a way for me to be around other people and have a purpose, but not have to be fully immersed in the room. And I just really love taking pictures, like literally from the age of 6 or 7 years old. And like all my pictures had people's heads cut off because I didn't know what a viewfinder was. And, you know, now it's just kind of evolved into something very different now.
I thought it was interesting, too, that you are documenting stories of queer elders because they have stories and they've seen a lot. And I know we as a community stand on their shoulders, you know. What was it like to interview them?
Oh, my God. The Queer Elders series that I'm doing for the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center, I think, really coalesces the work that I'm doing with the Resilience Archives, which is a spinoff organization from the Visibility Project, and the heart and soul of the Visibility Project itself, right? Because it uplifts the stories of these folks who came before us and who started these movements and had core contributions, right? The first video that I did was with an elder, Lenore Chin, who's I've known for, just got a Facebook alert that we've been friends for 9 years, okay, as of today.
All right.
And Lenore, you know, was a movement. She helped start the Queer Cultural Center. Mm-hmm. She was a core founder of Asian American Women Artists. She is one of the people who helped get Elle into the gay and lesbian rights movement, right? Like, mm-hmm, through her work with the Harvey Milk Democratic Club. And my perspective is just, I'm in that room to sit and listen and learn. And as the person who is directing and editing the videos, I want to honor their stories and not cut out pieces. Photography really transcends language. And people, you know, who are coming out to their parents, their grandparents, who don't have language, shared language around those words, around queer, you know, gay, lesbian, transgender, or those words in particular languages that exist, are only negative, right? And so I really wanted to look at that and frame it and make those connections, not just here, but through multiple generations of people in our community.
Was it hard to find people willing to be photographed?
It's still hard in certain places, definitely. There's lots of organizations actually on kind of like a national level. If you look at the timeline of when queer APA organizations have started, around 10 to 12 years ago, there was a large incubation of groups organizing in different major cities like Chicago, New York, you know, even St. Paul in the Twin Cities because of the same-sex marriage. When the Marriage Equality Act was passed on a federal level, there are so many different celebrations, but how many people did that actually impact, right? And the folks who are celebrating that could also, in certain states, go home, and if their employers found out that they were, you know, queer or LGBTQ, that they could get fired because of that. And there was no state laws protecting that. And, you know, just today, Chris Hayashi, who is the executive director of the Transgender Law Center, said recently at a conference that we are seeing record numbers of LGBTQ people on mainstream television and in movies, right, who are having like coming out stories and trans characters on TV shows, right? And simultaneously, we are seeing record numbers of hate crimes and violence enacted on those communities. So to me, visibility doesn't always equate to power and representation and allyship and solidarity. All these things have to coalesce together to really make change.
Tell us about the Resilience Archives.
Yeah, so the Resilience Archives was a spinoff organization of the Visibility Project, and I started it with a local organization. And it was a way for us to work together and collaborate to talk about and collect and archive histories of the queer APA community. And also, I wanted to use my knowledge and skills and expertise in archiving, preservation, digitization, interviewing, storytelling, and dissemination, right? To say, hey, none of us really knows what our community histories are, right? Fully. How much do you know about what queer Vietnamese activists have done? What queer South Asian activists have done, because we're either queer in certain, you know, groups, or we're Asian, and we have been at the forefront of all these social justice and civil rights movements. And so we really wanted to not just create this project, but to mentor up and train the next generation of archivists, the next generation of storytellers, and also articulate to people that your own personal histories are important and they are history.
That was photographer and archivist Mia Nakano speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. You can see Mia's work at an event called Performing Visible Resilience. It's May 31st at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Ababa. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. In this story from our archives, reporter Lizak Shallet takes us high atop a hill to explore part of the city that you really can't miss.
And we're looking at the Golden Gate Bridge north. And then if we turn east, we see downtown perfectly with shadows and sun. We can see across to the East Bay beautifully. And looking south, you can see the South Peak, and you can see down the peninsula to Daly City.
My name is Lynn Oakley, and I wrote Twin Peaks, the Twin Peaks book for Arcadia Publishers.
Oakley's been looking at this view most of her life. She's a fifth-generation San Franciscan who lives on Twin Peaks in the house her grandfather built almost 100 years ago.
So we're coming in the back. So this is the original house from 1920.
It's a brick house with a wrought iron gate on a street lined with million-dollar homes. But once upon a time, it was just an isolated cottage on stilts.
My grandfather, Edward Raymond Moffat, always called Moff, was considered the mayor of Twin Peaks because he was the first one up here this high.
Oakley's grandfather built the house himself with wood salvaged from the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition. His family thought he was crazy.
They said, you're a fool to go up there. There were no roads. There was no water, electricity, nothing.
Rising up more than 900 feet in the geographic center of San Francisco, Twin Peaks has always been a focus of the city's history and legends. The Ohlone believed the peaks were once a single mountain, united as husband and wife.
And they argued so much that God split them apart.
The Spanish called the two hills Los Pechos de la Chola, the breasts of the Indian maiden. And when San Francisco came under U.S. control in the 19th century, each hill was given its own name, Eureka to the north and Noe to the south.
Both of the peaks were underwater that millions and millions of years ago, about 2,000 miles, they figure, west of where we are right now, out in the Pacific. And with the continental plate shifting, it pushed these up.
Geologists know this by reading the rocks. Walk along the figure eight road that circles the peaks, and along the sides you'll see layers of rock about 2 inches thick. This is chert, small stones so sharp the Ohlone Indians use them for arrowheads.
And they make these thin ridge-like patterns in the rock, and we'll show you over here.
Oakley takes me up one dirt path and down another. We're headed to the southern peak to look for volcanic rocks that were formed underwater, called pillow basalt.
It's hard to see. It's kind of round. At the top of this hill, you see like cushiony type formations. And this hill, the southern peak, is made primarily of pillow basalt, while the other one is chert. So they're not identical. When they call them twin peaks, they're not really twin.
A bus with side mirrors like giant antennas zooms past us. Twin Peaks is one of San Francisco's top tourist destinations, and this driver seems intent on delivering his sightseers to the top before it clouds over.
Most of the tourists, though, go to the Christmas Tree Point, and it was called Christmas Tree Point because the firemen used to have a competition every Christmas to see who could decorate their firehouse the best. And the police said, oh yeah, well, we're going to put up an enormous Christmas tree, which they did in the, was it, 40s or 50s, right here at this point. And it was huge. It was about the height of these towers.
Oakley points to the fire and police towers that stud the summit. Across the parking lot, swarms of people crowd an observation deck. They're chatting in all kinds of languages, pointing out landmarks, and trying their luck with the telescopes.
Damn. Ate my money.
Where is the Golden Bridge from here?
Oh, I see. Oh, it's a little.
Not everyone's vision for Twin Peaks came true. Chicago architect Daniel Burnham had grand plans to turn the peaks into a European-style park with fountains and Greek pavilions.
And San Francisco embraced it, and it would be beautiful. Then we had the 1906 earthquake, and they said, it deals off.
So no fountains and no pavilions. Today, the lower slopes are thick with private homes. But the summit of Twin Peaks is protected by the San Francisco Recreation and Park Department.
Twin Peaks itself is sacred. You can't touch it. You can't build up there. And thankfully so. I just see that it's going to be taken care of. I think people realize what a treasure it is.
Atop Twin Peaks in San Francisco, I'm Lizak Shalit for Cross Currents.
We've got more audiographs about places all around the Bay Area. Find them all at kalw.org. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to our newsletter. Get our interviews and our pieces right in your inbox every single week. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.